Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me today. We have a special episode of the Deathcast. If you've been following along on the main show, you know I've been covering the murder of Roy Raden. Well, I've been lucky enough to get a guy who I think a lot of and quite frankly look up to, and that's private investigator Ed Opperman. Ed's agreed to come on the show and talk about the case and some of the things that many people may not be aware of. So, Ed, are you there?
Yes, Ian, thank you so much for bringing me on the show. I tell you, as soon as I saw you talking about Roy Raden, because I remember like 10 years ago when I wanted to do my first show about Roy Raden, I couldn't even find a guest. I couldn't even find it. Like, no one was talking about this guy. And it's just amazing how all this time later on, you know, just all these topics that were so obscure at one point. You know, yeah.
Yeah, I never had would never have heard of him without you doing a show with Steve Wick.
Yeah.
That's how I got introduced to Roy Raden. And then, you know, from there, the whole spinoff into Maury Terry's connection to it with the Son of Sam. So for my guests who are unaware of who Ed Opperman is, why don't you quickly let us know who Ed Opperman is?
Well, I'm a private investigator and a digital forensic investigator. I host a talk show on the radio 5 nights a week. You can catch it as a podcast, the Opperman Report, and all the podcast catchers. I play a live podcast Friday nights. We have a Patreon called the Opperman Report Patreon. And I guess that's about it. Just keeping busy.
Oh, yeah, you are extremely busy. You're probably one of the most busiest people I know online. So how did you first get into the whole Roy Raden story?
My first exposure to Roy Raden was we had this neighbor. I had a neighbor, okay? And when I first met his girlfriend, she told me she was 16. She told me she was 19, but she was really only 15. And they wound up getting married. I had a huge crush on this girl. Okay, I'll never forget the first day I laid she'd become my girlfriend later on, years later. Okay, but I'll never forget the first day I laid eyes on her. And at their wedding, which was held in the basement of their house right behind my backyard, they had Tiny Tim come as a guest, along with this her friend from California, this other 15-year-old girl I assumed was 19, named Lori LeVay. Mm-hmm. And so Tiny Tim was, you know, saying, I said, what the hell is Tiny Tim doing here? You know? And he goes, oh, yeah, you know, my friend is going on a tour with him. She's going to dance for this tour. And I says, okay, well, great, a lot of fun. So we hung out. And at the end of the night, Tiny Tim says, well, okay, who takes care of my appearance fee? But he wanted to get paid, okay? So we had to chip in, you know, get him a couple $100, whatever it was. And I didn't run into Tiny Tim again until years later at Yippie headquarters. Because I used to hang out down at Yippie headquarters. I used to be one of the Yippies back in New York City in the 70s. And I'm talking to him, and I said to him, hey, you know, like that night, you know, what if we didn't want to pay you? What would you have done? If we just would have, you know, smacked you around and kicked you out the door. And he goes, oh, I'm not worried about that because my manager is Mr. Roy Raden. And no one dares to stand up to Mr. Roy Raden. And that's the first time I heard the name Roy Raden. I think the second time I heard it was the whole Welcome Back Cotter thing. Mm-hmm.
So why don't you explain to the guests about the whole, you were telling me off air, you know, the connection between Raden and Welcome Back Cotter.
Yeah, the first female sweat hog was this woman named Melanie Holler. And she hits the news the next day, New York Post, front page, that there was this S&M party over at Roy Raden's mansion. And she was being abused there. They brought her in on a leash to begin with, drugged her and raped her, and then just pretty much dumped her at the train station half naked in the middle of the night, which was later on we found out was common for the parties at that mansion in the Hamptons over there. Mm-hmm. Years later, I became friends with the horse shack, Ron Palello, on Facebook. And he would talk to me about everything, all the stuff, the gossip behind the scenes, the homosexuality, all this kind of stuff going on with Welcome Back Cotter. The minute I brought up Melanie Holler, he would never speak to me again. It was the last time we ever spoke until he's died, you know, until his death.
Well, yeah, and that's You and I were talking off the air. She's kind of a dirty word in the entertainment industry, her name. And I was telling you, I actually covered this on the show. I'm looking for it right now is Brayden actually had some pretty heavy mob connections. Are you aware of that at all? Or
I was surprised to hear that when you told me that. But then again, when you look at the people that were on his tour, people like Larry Holmes, you know, who had clearly had mob connections, you know, Don King, that whole crew, and Joey Bishop and all those guys, you know, they all were around that kind of stuff. So I wasn't surprised in that way. And then plus knowing how they were doing those shakedowns with the vaudeville show, selling those tickets to restaurants and stuff like that. And then if the restaurants didn't want to buy the tickets, they would send like Sherman Hemsley over there or, you know, Red Buttons, you know, to go and pose with the restaurant owner, the bar owner. And then if they still didn't buy the tickets, you know, sometimes they get embarrassed, they buy the tickets. But if they still didn't buy the tickets, then they would break the windows, you know, or start a fire in the dumpster. And they couldn't do anything about it because all these road shows, these vaudevillian shows, were to benefit the local police benevolent association and all the firefighters and all that stuff like that. So the people had nowhere to call.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, that's really how he created, you know, his fortune is through these vaudeville shows. And I was just looking, this guy was actually his godfather. His name was Joey Stapelli, and he was a soldier in the Genovese crime family. So he had some, you know, pretty shady characters hanging around him.
Yeah, I believe there was a lot of drug dealing, too, going on. Plus, all those connections to the whole Process Church, the Son of Sam cult, and all that stuff, too, as well. It's alleged that he was filmed a snuff film of one of the Son of Sam hits.
Okay. You see, I'd heard that he had more likely than not filmed what happened to, Holler. And that you know, when the police went into the house, all the videotapes were gone. It was known he had a camera set up in his bedroom directed right at the bed. And that she had stated in her initial interview with the police that she had... he had videotaped the assault, but of course, when the police got there, he was tipped off in advance. There was no evidence other than blood stains, or what they assumed at first were blood stains on the floor outside of his bedroom.
Yeah, I think he got pinched with a gun, too.
Yeah, they found that in his closet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he said it belonged to a cop from, like, Louisiana or something.
What a creepy guy.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, you know more than I, you know, the stories that were out there about Tiny Tim.
Well, what other stories were there about Tiny Tim? Because it was really odd in my life that I knew several people who happened to know Tiny Tim.
I've read things online from people that knew him and that worked with him, basically stating that, you know, he was really into underage girls and, you know, he was known to make demands of places that were employing him of, you know, he wanted young girls there and, you know, putting his hands up their shirts and stuff in front, full view of everybody, that kind of stuff.
Really?
Similar to, some of the accusations that were made against Saville.
Yeah.
But these were, you know, one of those secrets that everybody seemed to have known and were around forever.
Yeah, I wasn't brushed up. I never really did any Googling of a Tiny Tim. But I do recall, you know, he would dress very oddly. You know, like he would be wearing like these tuxedo shoes with white socks. And then he would have like a tuxedo jacket with a big heavy sweater underneath it. And like a sausage.
Yeah.
You know, bursting from its skin there, you know. Mm-hmm. Good old Tiny Tim.
So now you mentioned, I haven't got to that part in the story on the main feed yet, but you mentioned, you know, Brayden and the Process Church. I know there's other connections there, including with Maury Terry.
So yeah, there were stories about him there in the Hamptons. Yeah, by the way, at one point he had the biggest house in the Hamptons, you know?
Oh, yeah, I've seen pictures of it. It's a massive place, Ocean Castle.
Yeah, and my sister and her husband, or I guess maybe it was her boyfriend at the time, they went to a party at that house. And my brother-in-law was disgusted by what he saw. And he was really outraged talking about all those porn stars and those kids. Mm-hmm. I guess he was talking about teenage kids, you know? And he was pretty much outraged by the whole thing.
Well, that was, you know, was and continues to be, unfortunately, that lifestyle. People don't seem to realize there's a lot of that going on even to this day.
Yeah, and there were stories, too, about that, like, Raiden would be walking down the street and with a cape on, with his cane, you know, and his top, fedora hat. In the middle of the street, he was a well-known character down there.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, from just looking up into him, he was known in the area, but outside of the area, unless you saw one of his shows, nobody really knew about him until the Holler incident occurred.
Right, and then even at his death, they just kept describing him as a producer. And I thought it was like a Broadway producer. You know? I didn't find out until later on. It was this weird vaudeville thing.
Well, his father had been a Broadway producer during the 20s and 30s, I believe it was. And then he kind of went through a similar situation where he fell on out of favor with everyone. And he was running a bar next to a strip club at the time of his death.
Roy Raiden?
No, Roy Raiden's father.
Oh, Roy Raiden's father. Yeah, okay, Al Raiden.
Yep.
Very interesting, yeah.
And he kind of looked up to his dad. But, I mean, you look into the stuff with him, there's a lot of, you know, twisted individuals hanging around with him. But as we were going to talk about, you know, the connections with Maury Terry.
Yes.
You might probably know more about that than I do, because if I'm not mistaken, Terry found a Bible or something where he was murdered.
Right. You know, and some people try and say that maybe Terry planted that there. I don't believe so. Raiden, well, he had that meeting with the Lainey Jacobs, I believe her name was, right?
Yes.
Right, who was involved with all these coke dealers and had a relationship with what's his name, Robert Evans.
Mm-hmm.
They were calling back and forth the whole night of that murder. You know, how Robert Evans skated away from all of that.
Yeah.
And some of the other stuff that guy was involved in. I actually had some problems with the Robert Evans estate for saying some things. So, you know, we've smoothed it over. So I don't need any more trouble.
We can stand around that. It's alleged.
Yeah. But it's just outrageous, you know, some of the things that went on there and how he got away with that's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. So that whole thing about how Damon Wilson from Sanford and Son was acting as Roy Raiden's driver and bodyguard the night he was killed. I tried to get him on the show, and we almost got him because, mm-hmm. he wrote a book about how commercials on TV have satanic jingles in them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get him on the show to talk about that, but then my producer at the time says, Ed knows all about the Son of Sam. He can't wait to ask you about this. And that was it, man. He just headed for the hills. He wouldn't touch me after that.
Well, you know, it's understandable. People don't realize he was tied into Raiden a lot more than, you know, they were just friends. Raiden was actually his business manager.
Hmm.
And, you know, they, right before Raiden went out with Jacobs, they actually were up in his hotel room snorting coke.
Oh, with the Damon Wilson, huh?
Yeah, and then Wilson's secretary came to pick him up, and, you know, the whole thing, they were going to follow him over to the restaurant, and that never happened, so Wilson just coked out of his mind, just decided to go to the restaurant and spend $150 on dinner.
Hmm.
Never thought anything of the fact that he was supposed to be here a while ago.
Yeah, that whole story is very strange, too, you know?
It is strange. You look at the, you know, he had really weird dynamics, Raiden did, with his clients. Some of them loved him, especially those who had heavy drug issues, but the ones who didn't really seem to come to hate him.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Roy Raiden Vaudeville group on Facebook.
I'm on that as well.
Okay, great. Well, we should probably keep it quiet then, right? And it seems like the comedians didn't like him, you know, mm-hmm. Milton Berle hated him, you know, and those kind of guys. But the musicians did seem to like him. Everybody on that page seems to really like the guy.
It's odd. It's, you know, like they only know the public persona.
Yeah.
because like you were saying, you know, the comedians hated him because he was ripping them off and running them ragged.
Yeah, yeah. But I've seen other, there's another group I'm involved in too with this guy's. As a matter of fact, one of the Roy Raiden hitmen, Bill Mancer, he was alone. He was the last person alone in the room with Carol King's ex-husband when he died. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and in that group, there's this character, you know, and it's all, everything's all, oh, my parties were so great. And meanwhile, the kind of stuff that was going on at these parties, you know, people dropping dead.
Well, yeah, and that's, I was going to get to Mancer.
Yeah.
Who is Bill Mancer? I know a lot of my listeners don't know who he is. I haven't got to that part in the tale yet.
Oh, really? Oh, that's a huge part. Yeah. Well, Bill Mancer was a bodyguard for Larry Flynt. He was one of Larry Flynt's bodyguards. And there was some kind of a dispute, a falling out with Flynt. And he went back there and there was a shootout with the other Larry Flynt bodyguards. He's convicted for killing Roy Raiden and was involved, too, with this other fellow, Marty, I believe his name. Is that the correct name, Marty?
I believe so.
Yeah, and Marty was also involved with the Raiden hit, but also, too, with this other murder of this 300-pound black transvestite madam escort service lady, okay? And when you read the facts about that case, it's even more – there was some blackmail going on, a lot of harassing phone calls, vandalism going on between these two back and forth. And at one point, this woman would be fighting with this kid, then get on the phone with the Vatican and be on a phone call with the Vatican, hang up and call the kid back. I've asked everybody involved in that what the hell was going on there. And no one even thinks to question it. Everyone's heard the story, but no one says what the hell's going on there.
Do you know the name of the woman who was on the phone by chance? Do you want to share it?
No, I don't know her name off the top of my head. No, okay. No. But so, that's that other murder that Marty was involved in.
Yeah, but Mancer's a pretty bad dude, if I'm not mistaken. He was called the Manson.
Second Manson.
Yeah.
Yeah, his private investigator, Tony Spurl, came on my show a few times. And made this whole argument that, oh no, Mancer was a bodybuilder and he wasn't like Manson, he wasn't a hippie. But the process guys, they were around Jack LaLanne and that whole bunch too of those gyms and stuff like that. They were all different walks of life were involved in all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Spurl hooks me up with this woman who was Mancer's ex-girlfriend, and she's reciting the same script almost word for word as Spurl gave me. Well, these folks over the years, they've tipped their hands. And Mancer's actually listened to the show and he liked the interview. Mm-hmm. And he likes me. He seems to think he has some kind of a deal in the future for a book or something.
Yeah. Wasn't he a member of the family at one point?
That's what Terry says. And yeah, that he was involved in Arliss Perry murder too.
Yeah, and the Perry murder is another one of those ones that's been linked, you know, to the Son of Sam. Correct? I believe Berkowitz mentioned
Berkowitz
it.
Himself. Berkowitz himself. And yeah, right. It leads back to Arliss Perry. And Arliss Perry's widow, Dr. Perry, has been involved in some really bizarre stuff in his life. Counseling the kids from, you know, from these mass shootings and Waco and stuff. Not specifically Waco, but you know he's involved in some really weird stuff. I did a show with Joe Green called "The Devil and Dr. Perry," and he laid it all out there, man.
Yeah, you know my listeners out there, if you're interested in finding that, I know you've got a Spreaker channel that's got everything on there.
Yeah, like 4,000 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I know yesterday you were telling me some stuff. Let me just look at the messages right now if I can.
Bill Ryder.
Yeah. So who is Bill Ryder?
Bill Ryder. There's certain occupations you're not allowed to point out. Okay. It's unlawful to mention what kind of occupations some people have.
Gotcha.
Right. But and there was a big story about that. The guy went to. Outed someone in that business and got in trouble for it. So it's alleged he's in that kind of occupation at one time at least. He was Larry Flynt's brother-in-law and also part of his security team. And it was his gun that he claims he loaned to Mensah that was used in the murder of Raiden. Now, there's a recording that I've heard of a writer talking to someone else, and I guess it was maybe one of the Mensah or Marti bragging about the murder of Raiden, where they says he was shot 13 times on Friday the 13th. But I think we found out that that's incorrect. That his death wasn't around a Friday the 13th, and that's just a thing that was said. So who knows with that? But
I think it was the 13th, actually.
Oh, you think so? Okay, I've always thought that that was some kind of just bravado. But if that's true, that's a big issue. And like you said, Terry went to the murder scene. He says he found a Bible there open to a certain page. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But the thing is, that was Bill Ryder's gun that was used to kill him. And Bill Ryder is the one who put the whole case together, taping everybody, and everybody went to jail except Bill Ryder. Mm-hmm. And there's people today that are still afraid of Bill Ryder.
Well, it's odd, you know, you've got so many of these people connected into, Larry Flint.
Yeah.
Nobody ever seems to bring up any of that in conversation. Do you think maybe Raiden was in cahoots with him at some point?
I'm sure they had some kind of connections. I'm sure they did. There's another interesting story about Bill Ryder.
Okay.
Because the FBI did a document dump of all their files on Larry Flint. And I have them in my Patreon in the free section. I think it's in a free section on the Opera Report Patreon. If you go there, you can find it. Mm-hmm. And there's a story about how Larry Flint hired Mitch Werbel, notorious CIA mercenary type guy, arms dealer, right? To assassinate all, he had a list of characters, Bob Guccione, Hugh Hefner, all these folks he wanted to kill. And he wrote a check. He wrote a check, man. Okay. No one denies this, by the way. This is official story. Larry Flint wrote a check to Mitch Werbel to do these murders. Mitch Werbel accepted the check. Okay. People around Larry Flint says, oh my God, what do you mean? These guys write a check for a hitman. Let's stop payment on the check. But somehow Flint got upset with Werbel. And the story is, and this is in litigation, there was litigation to this effect where this was testified under oath that Bill Ryder, the brother-in-law, poisoned Mitch Werbel. That's how he had the heart attack and died.
Okay. So now, maybe I'm mistaken, you might be able to refresh my memory. Wasn't there at one point a shootout at one of Flint's compounds?
Yes. That's what I said. That was a Mensah. Went back after he got fired. There was something in a safe that he wanted to recover. I wish I had this fresh on the top of my head, because I've heard the story several times from several different people. Ted Rubenstein used to work for Flint Publications too. And get this. Flint assigned them, hey, look into this murder of Roy Raiden and see what you can find out and come back with it. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't find anything at the time.
God, how that happened. You know, guys who work for him are involved in a murder. We can't find anything.
Yeah.
And the media likes to try and portray him as this, you know, advocate for, you know, women's rights and free speech and everything. And then you find out that he wasn't as squeaky clean and pleasant as they try and portray him.
Oh, no. Larry Flint was up to his neck in blackmail. He has a lot of blackmail dirt on a lot of people, a lot of video, a lot of stuff.
And that's kind of, you know, that ties into Raiden a little bit. You know, he was known to be, you know, to videotape a lot of things in his house.
Yeah, and same thing with the Manson family, the Tate LaBianca home there.
Yeah.
Videotape and all kinds of stuff. It seems, Hefner too had a catalog of videotapes. I believe Hefner was the one who had the tapes of Ronald Reagan doing some kind of gay porn. And who was the other one? Hefner has a lot of stuff.
Oh, I know people who have been to the mansion, and they've told me that it was you basically, if you were a woman and you were brought there, it was strictly to be as party favors to the elite that were at the place. And if you refused, you had a bad night.
Well, you know, I went to a party at the mansion back around 1980 or 82, around that time. A friend of mine had a limousine company in New York, and he was advertising on the Playboy Channel. We got an invite to go down there. And this was before Hef started taking Viagra.
Yeah.
And it was a really sad place at that time. At that time, it was a sad place, man. They're like the wood paneling, you know, like from the 70s, you know. And pinball machines. You know, it's a pathetic kind of place. And you go into the bathroom and it'd be like a women's tampons and a bowl, you know, and like dirt, you know, like it wasn't a clean place. It wasn't clean. And the girls were like, hey, when, you know, when are you getting off? When's your shift? You know, like that. Like they were forced to show, make an appearance. But it was a sad place when I went. I wasn't happy. But again, then again, it was all, you know, guys advertising.
Oh, yeah, well, it's, you know, the stuff I had heard, you know, was basically from the late 90s, early 2000s. I think it was the Grotto.
Yeah.
Was just disgusting. There was another room that had, like, the circular love couch that circled the whole room, which basically, you know, an orgy room, and the couch was all stained and moldy.
Well, you know, I interviewed that girl who grew up there. You know, her father was the doctor for the And she was best friends too with this woman who was really close to that Nicole, you know. Anna Nicole Smith, yeah. So, and they tell me some stuff, man.
Oh yeah, it's, you know, there's a glamorous side that they present, but the reality is often than not so awful.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else you've got on Raiden you'd like to share? Or?
Let's think. Well, the Mitch Webell thing, right? From Son of Sam, Vatican, Tranny, Tiny Tim, wedding. That's pretty much everything I can think of off the top of my head.
All right. Well, you know, I wasn't planning on doing a super long interview. Is any plugs that you would like to get in?
Any plugs? Well, let's see. I got a big show coming up. I'm trying to interview AJ Weberman. We're talking about that fellow Larry Ray. The Sarah Lawrence dad that was pimping out his daughter and his daughter's friends.
Yeah, I know that one.
Right. So turns out that Larry Ray was a source for A.J. Weberman's book about Giuliani called Pedo Thug. Because, you know, one of Giuliani's best friends is this pedophile priest. He has him on the payroll and stuff like that. And, you know, Giuliani also, too, was Epstein's corporate counsel.
Yes.
Over at Tower Financial, which nobody knows that except for the people involved. So I had a chance to talk to Larry Ray a couple of years. It was a long time, 2019. 2019 is still a couple of years going to be. Okay. But I had a chance to talk to him, and he makes a really good case, man, that he was set up by Bernie Kerik. And Bernie Kerik himself, the former police commissioner of New York City, who was the cop there on 9/11, says himself, own words out of his own mouth, that Larry Ray was my best friend. I saw him in the morning. I'd visit him at his house. He'd visit me at my house. We'd go to the gym every day. We were best friends. Paid for it. Best man I wanted. Okay. Best friends. So that, and other people have come forward and say, Larry Ray has always pimped out his girlfriends. He was married, but when he had girlfriends, he would let other guys sleep with his girlfriends. On September 11th, New York City, 2001, the best friend of Larry Ray was the police commissioner of New York City, who was on methamphetamines and pimping out his girlfriends. All right. And later on, this stuff with pimping out his daughter's friends, he was getting $8,000 a day. Okay.
Yeah.
Pimping out one girl, $8,000 a day on some crappy little website. It's not like he was luring in people because of his great SEO. These were people he knew. These were big money clients that he knew that he was pimping out this girl to. So there's a lot more to that story.
Yeah. And you brought up a case that I'm fascinated by. And if you want to talk about it for a couple of minutes, the Epstein case, because you were the first one on this.
I was the first one on this. Yeah, I did the very first radio show on Epstein in 2013. I couldn't even find a guest. I just happened to read a magazine about this guy. And I got lucky, and Robert Morrow was familiar with the content. But even then, we only did an hour with him. I did an hour by myself after that. Then later on, I was being interviewed about Epstein quite a bit. And one of the attorneys in the Katie Dole lawsuit, the lawsuit against Trump and Epstein, saw my, you know, my name was up all over the place, and he hired me as the PI in that case. Then I got involved in a couple of other ones and briefly consulted on some work down in the Virgin Islands. So I'm one of the few guys out there talking about Epstein that really had anything to do with it.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, you know, he supposedly died, and now nobody mentions it at all. But I mean, I know you had his former business partner on a ton.
Oh, yeah.
The Ghislaine Maxwell case.
Yeah, the good old, the late Stephen Hoffenberg, who was the CEO. First of all, he owned the New York Post for a while there. And he was the CEO of Tower Financial. And what happened was, you know, some kind of irregularities with the the finance over there. And, you know, Rudy Giuliani was the corporate counsel for that to keep it, you know, keep SDNY at bay, right? Which he was able to do. But soon as things started hitting the fan, Giuliani, Endike, Kahn, and Epstein all teamed up on one side, and Mr. Hoffenberg wound up going to prison for 9 years, holding the bag. And then when he got out of prison, he was still gnawing at that bone. He was gnawing at that bone for 9 years. He wasn't sitting on his bunk crying. And as soon as he got out, he's the one that initiated all that litigation in the Virgin Islands. And he's an unspoken hero, man, for what he did, getting that case opened up in the Virgin Islands, because a lot of money did pass on to survivors from his work.
Well, and that's, you know, people don't realize, you know, this case was kicking around for years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I mean, there's stories that, you know, he was released from the school he worked at, I think, in New York for improprieties in the 70s or something like that with the students.
Yeah, the Dalton School. He got that job through Bill Barr's father, okay, who later on ran interference for him again, too, by firing Berman for the SDNY prosecutor, the head prosecutor over there. And there was going to be a whole mutiny in that whole office. They were all going to quit until they appointed Berman's assistant. To take over that department. There was a lot of speculation, too, that those guys, Berkman and Wall, those two lobbyists and weirdos from D.C., that they were involved in that lobbying. They claimed that they were. Mm-hmm. Could never quite confirm that because they're just so full of crap, those two.
Yeah.
But Epstein had some kind of relationship with one of the girls over there at Dalton, and her father was the one. I forget where he went to Goldman Sachs or wherever he went to work. I forget what it was.
Yeah.
Was a big shot over at that brokerage, and that's how he got the job over there. Because of his relationship with a teenage kid.
Yeah, and that, yeah, no, he was like, you know, supposedly mentoring a bunch of the girls at the school. And, you know, they finally decided that was enough. And he went from the Goldman Sachs to working with Hoffenberg.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know who sent him over there? That guy, Lease. I think it's Patrick Lease, that arms dealer, you know, British arms dealer, they call him, you know, some kind of, another kind of spook.
Yeah.
That got him the job over there with Hoffenberg.
Yeah, and then he went from there, I believe, to Lex Wexner, correct?
Right, right, right. And Lex Wexner, he's up to his neck, too, in all that Ohio State
Yeah, I was reading stuff. That the other night.
Yeah, yeah. I got some really good paperwork, some of the court papers up on my Patreon. Plus, I interviewed one of the victims and one of the attorneys in that case, Radcliffe, Rocky Radcliffe. Great guy. But, you know, that abuse took place. Well, you know, they try and pin it all, isolate it to this one doctor who was feeling up the athletes. Mm-hmm. And that doctor's office was in the Wexner building. Okay.
Right. That's it.
And Wexner's wife is still on the board of trustees for that college right now, where this supposed investigation is going on. But what was they allowed anybody who worked at the school, the groundskeepers, teachers, anybody can go into the boys' locker room and shower with the boys. And this thing turned into a bathhouse where there were oral sex in the hallways and the stalls. And right under, what's his name? It was right there, Mr. Sleeveless shirt there, with a short sleeve shirt. What's his name? Jim Jordan, you know?
Yeah.
Right there. You got to hear some of the stuff people tell me off the air about this Jim Jordan and his in the steam room there with these guys. Some really, really bizarre behavior went on there. So, yeah, that's it's Wexner and Epstein.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, going back to what we were talking about before, there's, you know, the public image and then the reality of it. And you're at the heart of a lot of this stuff, finding the information.
Yeah, I know, more than I really want to be. You know, you got a couple of things going on right now. You know, more than I'm comfortable with anymore.
I get that. That's how I am with Saville. People don't understand how much I know about that guy that I don't make public.
Yeah.
Or about his alleged victims. You know, I've dug deep into these people.
Yeah, yeah. I interviewed his great niece, you know, who told them, you know, about how always Uncle Jimmy's coming over, and they put on his little dress, and then they sat her on his lap, and he went to work on her.
Yeah.
And then right in front of everybody, and then on her 19th, when she was 19 years old, at her engagement party, he showed up again and got her in a corner and molested her again.
Like, yeah, there's so many, you know, inconsistencies with stuff with that story. I mean, like, his nephew said that he never did anything. He was the greatest guy in the world. And then he said, oh, no, he left me in a brothel for gay prostitutes to be preyed on by people.
Wow.
You know, there was a pedophile ring that I want to say Hissing Sid was involved in. Sidney Cook. You've heard of him, the British pedophile killer?
No, I don't think I have, no.
Oh, yeah, he's like the most infamous in Great Britain. I actually did a show on it that YouTube flagged for targeting people.
Oh, man, I get that all the time. And they got me for bullying. I'm bullying Epstein. I'm bullying, was that guy, Alex Jones? You know?
He deserves it.
Yeah, what a character he is, man.
He deserves it. If I said half the stuff that frickin' that guy says, they'd have my head on a pike outside somebody's house.
You know, but speaking of Robert Evans, yeah, right, and that whole bunch up there, I got an interesting one for you. Mm-hmm. I do a show about Rodney Acala, the dating game killer, right?
Yes.
And the guest is telling me about how one of Acala's victims was dropped off in front of Marlon Brando's house with her vagina pointed right at Marlon Brando's door, like across the street. And they all lived in the same neighborhood.
Yes.
Brando, Evans, and the other, Jack Nicholson, you know, and all these characters, right? So I do that show, and the whole basis of that show, oh, no, the Rodney Acala, and by the way, Rodney Acala, too, man, he would pick up these girls and take them back to his mother's house and rape them and abuse them and mutilate them right in his mother's house.
Yes.
Okay. So it turns out later on, I do a show about the John Wayne Gacy with the P.I. Dorsch, you know? And the guy sends me a letter. I mean, he knows where there's more bodies buried. I've seen the letter from the Ground Penetrating Radar Company where they said, hey, man, we know where the bodies are. The cops will let us dig anywhere else except where those bodies are. Okay? They'll let us dig right next to the bodies, but not where the bodies are. And the whole story with that was that one of the victims found underneath Gacy's house, the mother, they did a DNA test, and it's not the kid that they ID it as, okay?
Yes.
And then there was this whole thing, too, about a neighbor is his, had some 400 names on a pedophile ring, and their names got lost, you know, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that what always happens. So I get an email saying, hey, Ed, this is a picture from Rodney Acala's house of a teenage boy, and look, it's that same kid that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid went alive, knowing Gacy, turns up missing, and somehow winds up with Rodney Acala.
You know, that feeds into my theories that, you know, Gacy, along with Dean Corll, was feeding victims to Francis Sheldon.
Acala was a film student of Polanski.
Yes. Oh, I know. I did a Patreon episode just on him after I covered the Manson family. Because they like to brush that one under the rug.
They sure do, man.
And I had a guy, a pretty big name director I was friends with on Facebook, go off on my page and then block me because I took issue with, the hell's his name, Quentin Tarantino making excuses for him on Howard Stern.
Mm.
And I was like, there's no excuse for what he did.
Yeah, I know. I see, even with Woody Allen, you know, I can't forgive these people. Yeah, I met the woman who was the model. You know what? Mariel Hemingway played that part in that movie Manhattan, where she was the teenage girlfriend of Woody Allen.
Yes,
I met the real woman. I found her, and she has an interesting story too, because you know she also worked for Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
She worked for Woody Allen. She dated Woody Allen. She worked for Epstein. She worked for Robert Evans, and she was the girlfriend of Carlos Castaneda.
And Carlos Castaneda, that name is ringing a bell, but I cannot pinpoint him.
It was like an artist type, you know, cult, yeah, all kind of stuff. But, and she swore up and down to me, Ed, I'm not a victim. Ed, I am not a victim. You know, I've had a lot of people tell me that I'm not a victim, Ed. I says, dude, we got a great lawsuit. You sure yeah. You're not a victim? No, I'm not a victim.
Well, it's amazing how many of these people pinball between the individuals that have either been, you know, convicted of or accused of various crimes. And people think that's a normal, you know, normal. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't have all these friends, you know, with these kind of allegations and the accusations and convictions, you know. You got this guy, Steve Bannon, you know.
Yes.
Who was very close friends with Epstein, way more close than anybody realized, you know, very close with Epstein. And by the way, too, endorsed my lawsuit against Trump and Epstein when he said, ask Ivanka, what about your father and that 13-year-old? So here he's a guy, he's friends with the co-defendant. Okay. He gave me an endorsement. But I did that show, Steve Bannon's Porn and Meth House, where I first interviewed a reporter about it, but then I interviewed the fellow who lived in the house after Steve Bannon did. And he found padlocks on the inside of the doors and the windows to keep somebody locked inside. Mm-hmm. And he actually says at the end of the interview, did I lose you there? You know what I
mean? No, I'm here.
Yeah, it says at the end of the interview, well, I hope this links up with more human trafficking cases in Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that. And by the way, there's no doubt too, man. Bannon's ex-wife is a porn star. Mm-hmm. She's a Swedish model porn star. She got caught bringing a cell phone and marijuana into her boyfriend's jail cell. She got arrested for that. There's all kinds of domestic violence incidents with police showing up at that location. That story, the Steve Bannon porn and meth house, they got the chemical samples from the meth. There's no doubt what went on there.
Well, and that's the thing. You hear about this stuff for a brief instant, then it goes away. It's got to be the money.
Yeah, I've seen that happen. I've seen that happen where we're working on a story, and then suddenly by the end of the day, it's all quiet, you know?
Yes.
The switch has been flipped. Like when we were working on the first Demi Moore, Ashton Kutcher, cheating allegations, and I pulled up his caller ID, I pulled up his phone number on her phone right there, clear as day.
Yeah.
And when we found that, there was no more arguing, but all Demi Moore had to say was, it never happened. And boom, it was like we were shot like a duck from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Story was over until he got caught again with a different girl. And then suddenly, oh yeah, it did happen.
Yeah.
But it's just that simple.
Well, that's people who don't know who you are. You work on a lot of big cases.
Yeah, I've been involved in a lot of stuff, man. You know, I've been involved in a lot of stuff. And there's some stuff, too, I'm working on right now behind the scenes. It's really big stuff, too. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of information on the Hunter Biden laptop that we're trying to put together. It's a great story, though.
Yeah.
you should have me come back for that one.
Oh, I'll definitely have you back. Yeah. You're allowed back on the show at any point. I love talking with you.
Yeah, the Hunter Biden laptop story is a good story. And it's so funny, too, because I've been a guest on it. I've told that, you know, I was a guest on TruAnon. You know, I was a guest on the, mm-hmm. and people will still say to me, Ed, how come you never talk about the laptop? How come we never talk about the laptop?
you do talk about it, but there's certain things that you can't say publicly.
No, actually, no. On that, everything I can say publicly. Everything's public. Everything. I'll come back. We'll do that whole story. It takes a little while, but it's one of the best stories I've got.
Okay, I will certainly have it. Just let me know when.
And I can make an argument. I can make a convincing argument that there would be no Hunter Biden laptop without Ed Opperman. That I got the ball rolling on that story.
Well, speaking of that, real quick, well, before we end, what do you make of all the stuff that was going on with Twitter and Elon Musk releasing all that stuff?
You know what? I really didn't follow it that closely. Obviously, when the Hunter Biden laptop stuff came up, and we had to go off of Twitter behind the scenes and emailing these pictures back and forth. Hey, is that an adult foot?
Yeah.
on Hunter's object there, you know, so you couldn't, it was so obvious what was going on. That was total censorship, you know, from up high, you know, but the Bidens have a lot of power and the Bidens have so much freaking power. You know, the thing is, the Hunter was partners with John Kerry's son when they were going around the world with their hand out, getting millions here, millions there. And without blushing, that Biden appoints John Kerry back to another cabinet position. You never see him, because all he needs is the name on paperwork to go out with their hands out and get money. And this whole Ukraine stuff, man, isn't that a conflict of interest? That we got this president handing billions of dollars over to Ukraine when there's so much controversy in the past? Like, call me naive.
And now he's suddenly over there and nobody in the U.S. knew about it, but Putin did.
Oh, really? Putin?
Yeah, that was an article I was reading today. Apparently Putin knew he was going over there.
Oh, good. Well, I think they got deals with Putin.
I do, too. Honestly, if Putin wanted to end this war quickly, it would be over.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Putin made a deal with Hillary about the contents of those emails, that a deal was made. If you read the Roger Stone indictment, it talks about how the DNC became aware that their computers were hacked, and then they hired CrowdSource.
Yeah.
So how'd they become aware? They got a phone call from Putin. We got to make a deal, you know?
Yeah, there's so much intrigue in that, all of that stuff. All right. I think we're going to wrap it up here. Again, plug your stuff, Ed. Let everybody know what you're up to, where they can find you, where they can listen to your show.
Well, the name of the show is The Opperman Report. And if you Google that, all those podcatchers come up. The best place is Spreaker.com, as Ian said, because if you go there and sign up at Spreaker.com, it's free. There's a chat room. And you get an email notification when I put up new content. I play repeats every night of the week, and I play 3 hours of brand new content on Friday nights. To get everything, you got to go to Patreon. But there's some real cheap ad-free content on there you can get for $3 a month. And then there's exclusive stuff. There's a lot of, like I'm going to put up this Dominion software litigation against Fox News. I'm putting that up tonight. But I've had that Proud Boys handbook that everybody's been talking about. Oh, the Proud Boys, did you read this? I've had that since 2019.
Yeah.
Okay? You're right, being those. I've had that thing for years, man. The 24-page Epstein letter, man, where he says he created the Clinton Foundation. I had that thing since like 2014, 2015. When Epstein died, all these places, Business Insider, they were buying that from me. Mm. Okay? For $1.99, by the way.
There you go.
It was a bargain. But yes, there's a lot of great stuff on Patreon you should check out.
Yeah, and I'll second that. I'm a member of the Patreon, and Ed puts out a lot of good shows that aren't even on the Spreaker feed.
Yeah, yeah. And we cut all the ads out and stuff, too.
Yes. So, all right. Thank you so much for coming on, Ed. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you, Ian. I had a really good time. I've been having a rough week, you know, so thank you very much. You really cheered me up.
I'm glad to hear that. Again, you can find Ed on Patreon and on every podcast app you can think of. Just look for the Opperman Report. I've been on there a couple of times.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's it for this week. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.